Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Tuesday, the 17th of November. Finding truth in headlines and news stories, our topic this hour. We'll have two guests with us. John Allen Paulos is a professor of math at Temple University in Philadelphia, who received his PhD, we must say, in math from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's an author, a public speaker, a monthly columnist for ABC News, and formerly for The Guardian. And he's written a number of interesting things. He explains in several books, a mathematician explains why the arguments for God just don't add up. Irreligion is that book. In Numeracy, a mathematician reads the newspaper once upon a number. A mathematician plays the stock market and is also the author of many op-eds, book reviews, and articles in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, The Nation, Discover, The American Scholar, and the London Review of Books. Later this hour, we'll be speaking with a senior fellow for Media Matters for America. And he will be looking at finding truth in news stories. Sarah Palin, of course, is all over the place this week, all over the press. And she has been saying that she wants fact-checking to be done, that she thinks that the Associated Press has had some errors. And people are saying that her book is filled with inaccuracies and it's going back and forth. And so how do we check facts? How do we find the truth? If the truth is to be found, our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that. That address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, John. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. And you've got a lot of Wisconsin ties. Is it amazing how many people have Wisconsin ties who we get as guests? And we didn't know about it until we read their bios.
Okay. Yeah. Well, in one sense, I mean, if you push hard enough, probably almost everybody does.
Yeah, I guess maybe you're right. So you confess, you do read tabloid headlines. I do, too, when I'm standing in line at the supermarket, some of which may have kind of a kernel of truth.
Many of them are literally true and yet, nevertheless, seriously misleading, and I particularly am drawn to those. And as I mentioned in a recent ABC column, I listed a few such headlines that I would imagine could appear and show why they're both true and seriously misleading.
Starting with thousands to die after swine flu.
Yeah, thousands will die after getting vaccinated for swine flu, or at least many hundreds, depending on the assumptions you make. And the reason for that is there are about a million heart attacks in this country annually, and almost a million miscarriages as well. And that's about 3,000 of each every day. If you assume 100 million people, Americans, will be inoculated over a six-month period, that's 200 times as many flu shots daily. It's a virtual certainty there'll be many people who will have a heart attack or a miscarriage shortly after receiving the shot. And, of course, people might make much of this, and it will feed into the anti-vaccine hysteria that seems to grip many people.
Yeah. So your advice is get the shot.
Get the shots, yes.
Yeah.
Inoculate yourself not only against the flu, but against nonsense in newspapers, not just tabloids.
Does it go a lot beyond tabloids? Do you find mainstream press has a lot of kernel of truth, but misleading headlines?
Right. It's. I think it's a continuum. It's. I think not quite so overt and egregious, but often headlines are slapped onto stories which are at odds with the stories. Sometimes the stories themselves are, of course, misleading. But, having written a number of reviews and op-eds and whatever, I'm often upset at the way they're headlined.
Right. What about these birther stories? I guess they've died off a little bit now, but my gosh, we were just, we get them on public radio every now and people who call in and they get obsessed with this story. I guess it must be quite the subject for tabloid news as well.
It is. If my cursory perusal in the supermarket is any indication, but so I thought I'd come up with a tabloid headline myself, and that is new birther claims about Obama well documented. And just the story is that a new birther group has come up with incontrovertible evidence that President Obama was in fact born overseas and not in the contiguous United States. And the documentation is rock solid. There are reports that Obama himself has privately acknowledged the group's claims. And, of course, that's true, but he was born overseas, but he's although not over the seas that the headline suggests, overseas in Hawaii. And he wasn't born in the contiguous United States, but if someone doesn't understand the meaning of the word contiguous, that seems quite ominous. So,
all right, let's lay that baby to rest, right? That's
it
done.
Reminds me of the P.T. Barnum story about people spending too long in his museum, so he put a little sign over the door to the egress, and people thinking there was a new exhibit there went to go see what the egress looked like and found themselves outside.
What about this story? You know, it's interesting how they can make, and it was all over the news too, about female happiness, whether or not there's declining female happiness. Are women happier than men? How about in the 70s? How about now? It was a fairly big news story, but you say that it just, you know, numbers fluctuate so much that there's not really a story there? Is that what you're saying?
There isn't really much of a story. I mean, people have taken surveys over the last 30, 40 years and asked representative samples of how happy are you, which is, you know, of course, two problems with that. Happiness is a very nebulous notion, and self-reporting is often very dubious. But the results for men and women vary in... The trend is just barely statistically significant, but statistically significant is much different than practically significant, and that's assuming that there's anything to self-report on a nebulous notion like happiness. But nevertheless, I mean, there's very tiny differences, and yet people have made much of it. I mean, liberals blame women's extra burdens, conservatives blame feminism, people pontificate with... almost, you know, no basis. I mean, the authors of the study did not make these claims, but people with various political agendas pounced on them and drew the conclusions they were wanted to draw, no matter what the stimulus.
So, in other words, sometimes we're very happy, sometimes we're pretty happy, and sometimes we're not too happy.
Right, and if you ask a bunch of people, the percentages of men and women over the years are going to fluctuate some, and I don't think it's warrant for any sort of big conclusion.
Mm-hmm. A couple questions about health insurance. I know that you've written about this. Opponents of health care reform citing surveys showing that most people are quite satisfied with their insurance.
That's probably true, but it's also the case that most people are healthy. Relatively few of the people that are surveyed are seriously ill, and so they don't place any significant demands on the system. And so, of course, they're satisfied with it. I mean, but it's better to focus on a more telling reference class. I mean, seriously ill people who've actually needed considerable help. I mean, an analogy might be people that have no strong opinions about anything are likely to think that, you know, the right to free speech is quite secure. And but the right to free speech is only important when someone is actually saying something unpopular. And the right to health care is only, you know, a real entity when someone is very sick.
Mm-hmm. So we should poll people, or we should at least tell, we need much more of an explanation here in terms of who we're polling on these issues?
Right. I mean, I think the proper reference class is, you know, people who have had significant contact or interaction with the healthcare system and or lack thereof because they don't have insurance or are underinsured.
And what about this statistic? I heard it again last night, that 45,000 people in this country have died last year as a result of no health insurance.
That's a That just came out fairly recently. I mean, that number is open to dispute, since it's, and anytime you want to estimate a number of that sort, there's going to be all kinds of imponderables, and you're going to have to make all sorts of assumptions, each of which is open to argument. But the fact is, lots of people have died, will die without the health insurance, and the number is probably higher than has been estimated. And that's really figured in discussions. I'm just drawn to a parallel I read in a Nicholas Kristof column that was quite compelling. I mean, he said that there's the cost for continuing the war in Afghanistan for another year will be about $100 billion next year. Healthcare reform this next year will be about $100 billion, and we have to decide whether it's better to blow things up in Helmand Province or to, as he says, build things up in this country.
Hmm. So that's a case where numbers can be used in a fairly dramatic, I don't want to say simple because it's not really simple, it's quite profound, but a pretty dramatic fashion in a clear set of choices?
Right. I mean... And the Iraq War, I mean, to go back a few years, I mean, it cost at least $1 trillion, probably more. And people weren't wringing their hands, unfortunately, about the cost of the war and the total cost of healthcare over the next decade. And now, all of a sudden, it seems insurmountable to many people.
Yeah. What does it mean? You wrote a piece on... We always get into this fire season, and it seems as though there've been, it's a kind of extended, so the stories of fires, particularly outside L.A., have been all over the place during the fall. You write a piece about a fire being such a percentage contained.
Yeah, I think, it's always confused me. What does it mean to say a fire is 40% contained? And basically what it means is if you can draw a line or a curve around the fire, and that line is 20 miles long, and along 8 miles of that line or perimeter, there's a fire line or a trench that's been dug, then the fire is 8/20 or 40% contained. I mean, it's how far away from the fire you draw the line is not clear. I mean, if you draw it sufficiently far away, you could have it 100% contained. It would still be burning out of control for days, possibly. Mm-hmm. Another factor about fires, though, is it's always kind of amazed me. It's not amazed, but struck me. It's network news, television news of all sorts, always reports the area of the fire that is in acres. And I find very few people know how many acres are in a square mile. I ask students of mine, I ask people in general, and they don't know, but yet they say, 23,000 acres are ablaze. There are 640 acres in a square mile, and a square mile is much more easily visualizable.
Yes.
So 23,000 acres is the same as about a square 6 miles on a side, which somehow is... less alarmist, which is probably the reason for using acres. It sounds.
Do you think so?
Threatening.
We're blowing this thing up. I mean, it's a bad thing, but we're making it larger in our minds.
Right. It seems more. It's more alarmist. It justifies the interminable coverage of fires, which are serious and tragic. But to some extent, most fires are more or less the same.
Yeah, that really struck me when they had that really bad weather. Was it North Carolina or South Carolina? They all blend in, unless it's a horror story like Katrina. But two nights in a row, the same guy dressed in almost the same uniform on the same pier, I think it was in North Carolina, did you see that, giving us pretty much the same story? The wind was blowing just as hard, if not a little bit harder. He could hardly stand up.
I know. They have their raincoats on and their hoods. And if you could kind of subtract away the bad consequences and the tragedy.
Yes.
situation. Yes. It's kind of funny because you're right. He's always leaning into the wind and water dripping down his or her face. And oh, boy.
I know. Let's take some phone calls. Greg from Oconomowoc. Hi, Greg.
Hello. I have a question. It has to do with the article which I read yesterday in the newspaper from the USDA survey about the number of hungry people in the U.S. And I think I'm saying that correctly, you know. But anyways, you know, I was trying to read the article to really understand what that meant. And there were just a lot of numbers with a lot of general questions. And then the general questions were, the answers from those were kind of combined. And they came up with this number of, I think it was 49 million people in the U.S. are hungry. And again, you know, hunger and poverty are a big issue. But it just seemed to me that nothing of substantiation could be actually taken from it. There was just like too much information. I'm just wondering if your guest read that article, was aware of that survey, and what his thoughts were about it, if he was able to really get some concrete, answer or results, you know, from that survey and that report.
I just glanced at it. I did see the headline. As I said, like a lot of these numbers, it's impossible to evaluate the claim unless you know how it was arrived at. I mean, in any claim, if you look at the number, if you ask about the number of homeless people in a city or number of battered women, I mean, it depends on how the number is obtained. I mean, if it comes from police blotter report, for example, I mean, the number is likely to be low. If it comes from a scientific study, it's liable to be higher. It comes from if it comes from a press release of a group that has an ideological axe to grind, it's likely to be higher still. So unless you know the origin and protocols of how it was arrived at, you just kind of nod and say, well, maybe. I mean, the fact is there are lots of people that go to bed hungry, even in this country. That strikes me as kind of high, but I'm just talking off the top of my head now, so I wouldn't want to stand behind that suspicion.
So do you think that we are owed, and sometimes you get a little bit of an explanation of so many people were interviewed over such a period of time, here was the makeup of what we did. Do those need to be much fuller explanations?
Yeah, I think they do, at least for those people who want to investigate further. Because, I mean, most people just, virtually all people, I mean, given time constraints and so on, look at the headline. And if the headline, to get back to tabloid headlines or headlines in general, if the headline is not consistent or misleading, not consistent with the story itself or misleading in some way, it's not clear. And the kind of motive behind a lot of headlines is to engage the reader, to grab them. And you grab people by being hyperbolic, by being alarmist, by being, you know, engaging or whatever. And that's often not the story.
We go to more phone calls in just one moment. Our guest is John Allen Paulos, professor of mathematics at Temple University, author of A Mathematician Reads the Newspaper, as well as Irreligion, A Mathematician Explains Why the Arguments for God Just Don't Add Up. He writes a monthly column, Who's Counting?, which runs monthly on abcnews.com. And we'll take one more phone call for him, and then we'll be changing guests. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take one more phone call, and then we're just changing guests and slightly changing topics, although it's still on the track of the truth, finding the truth in the press. Yvonne from Appleton, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Dr. Paulos. I've read your books, and I admit that I don't have enough mathematical ability to understand enumeracy. The thing that really puzzles me, though, is just general irrationality. I personally know people who are convinced that they're going to be the victim of a kidnapping or a terrorist attack, and yet they drive 80 miles an hour down the freeway without a seatbelt with their cell phone going.
Oh my!
I don't get those people.
I agree. In enumeracy, there is not a whole lot of technical mathematics. I mean, often what you do need is a certain amount of common sense, an ability to think somewhat rationally, and some feeling for numbers, the difference between millions, billions, trillions, and an ability to at least roughly assess risks. You're right, going down the expressway at 80 miles an hour and drinking and smoking and your young daughter standing between in the front seat playing with the rearview mirror is vastly more risky than the conversation between, let's say, the overweight mother and the overweight father in the car. And they're talking about the risk from pesticide residue on grapes. So, I mean, people without a feeling for relative magnitudes will, you know, say, oh, got to watch out for grapes, or got to watch out for terrorist attacks, or you know, some other vivid but very unlikely threat, and are oblivious to ubiquitous and banal threats like smoking, obesity, or whatever. I couldn't agree with you more.
Hmm. Thank you very much for the call. And is part of this that we're just not as smart as we ought to be when it comes to mathematics?
Numbers are kind of abstract, and people, same people who are, you know, skeptical of an account of somebody's relationship or some business dealing, their eyes glaze over when the topic is numerical. I mean, well, one fact I find interesting is most people have no real visceral grasp of the difference between million, billion, and trillion. One way that I clarify them is to note that a million seconds takes about 11 and a half days to go by, and a billion seconds takes about 32 years, and a trillion seconds takes 32,000 years.
Oh, my gosh.
And people tend to lump them together, perhaps because they rhyme, but think of it as a jail term. You want to go to jail for 11 and a half days, or maybe for 32 years, or maybe for 32,000 years.
Oh, that's amazing. I'll never think of those numbers in the same way. That's remarkable. John, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen. I've enjoyed it.
John Allen Pauls, professor of math at Temple University in Philadelphia, looking at numbers in headlines as we attempt to find truth. We'll continue our search for truth in the news. Eric Bullert is joining us now, and we're going to be looking at accuracy in what we see and what we hear when it comes to news. There have been several examples recently, and some of this may be just covering breaking news, like what happened at Fort Hood and the news that a young police woman at Fort Hood, who was a patrol person, sort of civilian patrol, I believe, was responsible for the hitting of Major Hassan, and it turned out that that wasn't exactly the right story. She was made a hero and called a hero repeatedly and repeatedly until the person who really brought him down came forward and said, no, I'm sorry, I was the person who did this. We'll talk about that and whether any harm is done there. What about Sarah Palin being all over the place this week? I guess she's a personality. Is it the personality thing that we're living with here, or she really is, we're already looking at 2012 and she's the candidate, or what does it signify? And what's going on with her comments that the Associated Press was going on an opposition research mission rather than fact-checking her book? Now we've got John McCain's camp saying it's filled with inaccuracy, so we get that story all week long. Do we care, I guess, is the question. Eric is the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Eric. And here's our number for this conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email again is talk@wpr.org. Hi, Eric. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me.
I can't believe, and I'm wondering what it is about us, that Sarah Palin is, it's not only is she, the book is just coming out today, I believe, but we've already had at least 4 days of stories and previews of the interviews that we're going to get this week, and this bickering of what the truth is, and back and forth between the Palin book and the McCain camp, et cetera. Don't we have anything else to occupy our attention?
Well, this is really an example, I think, of how when the Beltway Press decides it's going to do what it's going to do, nobody really has a choice. I mean, the whole machinery has geared up for this, and they're geared up for it because it's easy. It requires no thought, no reporting, no actual analysis. I mean, I haven't. I mean, I have to watch some of it on TV during the day. I literally have not heard one insightful comment yet, ever, about Sarah Palin or the book or anything. Everyone knows what everyone's going to say. It's all pre-programmed, and it's easy, and it's lazy, and it passes as news inside the Beltway, but it's utterly sort of irrelevant process stuff.
And so who's making the decision that that's what we're going to get for a good chunk of this week? When we could be looking at the history of U.S.-Chinese relations, there's a lot about we need to know about China and the economy and the world economy. We could use a little in-depth story on that, right?
We certainly could. We could use reporting on all kinds of things. But this is what the Beltway Press loves to do. It's process, pure and simple, politics process. And oppose what they don't like to do is public policy. So whenever they have an opportunity to do just process stuff, they do that. And again, what's also interesting, it's not even just process. If you take a step back, I mean, if you look at the polling, I mean, Sarah Palin is sort of perennially unpopular. The polls that I've seen, which indicate that a very clear majority of Americans think she's sort of singularly unqualified to be president. So it's not as if, you know, it sort of reminds me of the Colin Powell boomlet in the 90s. But at the time, I think people thought if he ran, he could pretty easily beat Bill Clinton in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's anyone who takes politics seriously who thinks Sarah Palin could do any of that. So it's very bizarre. I mean, she was on a ticket that was lost in a landslide electoral defeat, and there's really no precedent for the press to treat the loser as some sort of rising political star.
Yeah, exactly. And it's reached a level, maybe it's just our love of soap operas and tabloids and drama and fascination with political figures who we make kind of our kings and queens, not that she falls into that category. But the whole thing about the almost son-in-law and the Thanksgiving dinner questions, there's something just gossipy about all of that that we must like.
Well, it is gossipy, and I do think that gossip angle would not be attached to a male candidate. So I think there's still sort of a level of newness, the fact that she is a woman as she's young-ish for a national politician. And so I think that opens the door for the press to do even more sort of vacuous commentary.
Right. Well, she opens the door for that as well, don't you think?
Yep. Yeah. Oh, no question. And she also opens the door for just sort of incessant, sort of media discussion. I mean, the book itself is very peculiar as a book to try to launch a political career. It's very whiny. It's a lot of score settling with Republicans. I think it was the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal Book Review that noted that, the final chapter, which was supposed to be the quote-unquote policy chapter, was a total of 13 pages and read like a bad stump speech. So blogger Andrew Sullivan has always written and stressed that Sarah Palin has no self-awareness, and I think that's true with this book.
Let's talk about coverage of Fort Hood, a story which certainly is still developing. I'm interested in how the press kind of got some of the story wrong and made this young female police officer a hero, and it turned out that she didn't fire the defining shot, and also how the press has been covering the person who obviously committed to presumably it's hard to believe that he didn't commit this horrendous crime, and his background and the element of terrorism, and all of that. Good job, mediocre job. What needs to be filled in here?
Well, I think of the breaking news, there was a lot of erroneous reporting, but that happens. I don't think it's the end of the world. I mean, usually, decades ago, we just never saw that raw information that was part of the reporting and editing process. And now, of course, everything's done in broad daylight and transparent. And, there was lots of erroneous reports. You know, for instance, he had converted to Islam and things like that. In fact, Charlie Gibson ran with that on the night of World News Tonight on ABC News, and that was inaccurate. I guess in general, I think they did fairly well. You know, obviously the right-wing media has been stoking this terror angle, complaining that the press won't call it an act of terror or a jihadist and things like that. But I think the mainstream press has sort of kept a fairly level head, mostly because I think army investigators certainly weren't going there, the press did a pretty decent job of uncovering facts about the shooter and what possible connections or ties he might have had with some more radical elements and things like that. So I think over time, a relatively interesting and relatively complete picture began to emerge, and I think it was helpful to put that all together. In terms of the shooting, you mentioned the woman, the female, I guess she was a civilian officer.
Yes, right.
That was just peculiar. Two things were peculiar. A, I'm almost sure on that day the Army announced that Hassan was dead.
Yes,
about six
right.
hours later, they announced, oh, he's actually alive.
Right.
And then I think it was the Army and the base that first released all this information about the woman, how she came around the corner and shot Hassan, and the press went with that. And then a few days later, we found out, well, actually, another guy probably shot him. I don't know why that happened, and you can't really fault the press too much. I mean, they were told by official sources this is what happened. It did remind me a little bit of the Jessica Lynch story from the first weeks mm-hmm. of the invasion, where the government was obsessed with. I think that was much more clear-cut case. They were obsessed with creating this heroic figure for, and really created that tale out of whole cloth. I just don't understand. I don't know if it was just a miscommunication or something else was going on. And again, I don't think you can really blame the press if what little official information they get turns out to be wrong.
So the information, and it seems to me as though this is a pretty big mistake for this guy to have been declared dead, and then 6 hours later he's not dead.
Yeah.
It doesn't take that much to determine whether or not somebody is dead, does it?
I've never seen any good explanation of how that happened. If the Army doesn't want to explain, the Army's not going to explain.
Huh.
What I thought was fascinating, and I've written about in the past, and the first time it really struck me was in the wake of the Virginia Tech massacre. The press doesn't talk about handgun control at all.
Mm-hmm.
There was virtually no interest in where Hassan got his guns and where he got his pockets full of ammunition, how he was able to carry that onto the base. Did he buy the gun legally or illegally? I've still seen virtually no reporting on that. But it's interesting, you know, after Columbine, there was a national debate about gun control,
right.
gun laws,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. And now that discussion literally does not even take place. I did an electronic search in the 24 hours after Fort Hood, and there was between all the cable channels, including CNN Headline News, CNN, MSNBC, Fox, there was exactly one reference to gun control in almost 24 hours of coverage. So I find that interesting that the press has just taken that off the table completely, even if in the wake of handgun massacres.
Why?
I think they're convinced. No, well, with Columbine, Bill Clinton sort of led that debate. That was a conversation he wanted to have. I think the excuse the press has, well, Democrats don't want to talk about gun control, so we're not going to talk about gun control. And there's an element to that, but last time I checked, the press didn't wait around for the DNC to call and tell them what to write about and what not to write about. I mean, the press, of course, is supposed to act independently of political parties, but I think they've mostly been convinced by either polling data or sort of the NRA or the right-wing media that nobody cares about gun control and that somehow the debate is over in America.
Mm. Let's take some phone calls. Dave from Augusta. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. I got a couple of views on this topic with Sarah Palin. I believe the more controversy she stirs up with the McCain camp saying that's true, that's not true, and then on her side saying that's true, that's not true, that's going to sell books. And I think as long as she keeps that book in a lot of conversations, it's going to she's out to make a lot of money. That's probably the reason why there's such banter about the book. Also, my last statement is, boy, do I miss Walter Cronkite.
Oh, I know. So do I.
Yeah,
I
you
always,
bet.
I always will.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Eric?
Yeah. I mean, this whole thing is designed to sell books and not much more. I mean, I feel sorry for people who are actually trying to deem or get any real information out of this. Yeah, I mean, she's trying to sell books. That's why she quit her job to be, as governor, because she wanted to make more money. And that's why the press covers her nonstop, because she brings in eyeballs, just like Obama did last year. So she's good for business, and I understand that, and that's fine, but it seems the press has no self-control, no mechanism, has no idea when to say stop. I don't know if we need, you know, 14 hours of Palin coverage each day. I would think 4 would probably cover it on the cable news channel. but it just becomes this thing that no one turns off, and everyone just keeps saying the same thing over and over.
Right.
And it becomes sort of comical. Of course, the irony is, you know, the basis of the book or the basis of the conservative push is poor Sarah Palin has been persecuted by the press, and you know, they've given her, I don't know how many millions of dollars in free publicity this week. So that's always a bit tough to swallow.
Yeah, exactly. We had Charlie Peters on with us yesterday. We do this All Things Political show, the founding editor of the Washington Monthly.
He
was a terrific guest. And he was talking about, he gave us an hour of original thought, but he was talking about the lack of original thought, and he was right on with that. So that you can watch either Fox or if you're watching MSNBC, you can watch for 4 hours at night, and you're hearing the same thing, really, hour after hour after hour. There's just not much original thought. There may be a little bit every now and then, but it's essentially, you know, the same viewpoint, the same thoughts over and over and over again. It can drive you crazy.
Yeah, and in general, it can drive you crazy. But then when they focus on the same minute topic, it becomes really, I mean, this is going to go on for 3 more days. I mean, honestly, it reminds me of, in a way, when Ronald Reagan died, or when Tim Russert died.
Yes.
I mean, it was just the same conversation for like 98 hours.
Right. Yeah, it sure was. John from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to point out what, to me, I think was one of the big failures of the mainstream media, and that was initially in the Bush administration. They allowed them to get away with violating the Constitution in respect that the 12th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution requires that the president and the vice president be from different states. Now, Dick Cheney had been working in Texas for many years as a CEO at Halliburton. And the day before Bush nominated him as vice presidential candidate, he changed his voting registration to Wyoming. Now, if we're going to allow the Bush administration to sidestep the U.S. Constitution by changing the voting registration the day before he gets nominated, we may as well eliminate that from the U.S. Constitution, because there's no value to having it in the U.S. Constitution if you can just change your voting registration the day before you're nominated.
Eric.
Yes. Well, that makes me nostalgic for the 2000 campaign. That was one of many things that I thought the press completely fell down on, and it's a good footnote in history, and you're right. That was sort of an early indication, or an early tell, I think, that the press was going to sort of let the Bush campaign do whatever it wants. And the Bush campaign was sort of operating on another level, and while they dogged everything Al Gore did and every sweater he wore and every supposed exaggeration he made, here was a case where the Bush campaign sort of simply ignored or rewrote the law. I doubt the press spent 4 hours on that story, as I recall. So it was just a non-starter because Republicans didn't want it to be a non-starter, and the press was so determined honestly, to exact some Clinton-era revenge on Al Gore that they couldn't care less about the Bush-Cheney sort of shenanigans.
Were they also a little bit cowered by conservatism? Because
Well, I mean, the press bashing has been a cornerstone of the conservative movement for four decades. It's been very successful and it helps them raise a lot of money in fundraising, but it also it works. I mean, the press has developed real rabbit ears about this liberal media bias charge. And of course, what's the best way to prove you're not a liberal? You sort of go easy on a Republican presidency and candidacy, which we certainly saw during the Bush years.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Joining us this hour is Eric Bullard. He is the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. He is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America. He's been a contributing editor for Rolling Stone. And we're talking about finding the truth. And we're looking a little bit at some of the obsession, this Sarah Palin thing that's going on all week long. Well, it already started a few days ago, so it's going to be Sarah all over the place for the whole week. And why that's the case and how the press has dealt with some of the major stories and has gotten some things wrong and whether or not that's a big deal. So that's what we're talking about. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Ron from Milwaukee. Hi, Ron.
Hi, good morning there. I've noticed even on NPR there seems to be sometimes a lack of critical analysis of what's being reported. Sometimes, you know, the government makes statements, and then they're just repeated, of course, by all the Fox News and those people. How can we as citizens begin to discern? How can we teach our kids critical thinking when there is all this mishmash out there in the media? And what do we do about government lies that seem to permeate even our myths about 9/11 and other things? I mean, how can we judge? There are not even any investigations of things like 9/11. That anyone can trust. So what do you think?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's tough because, I mean, I grew up with sort of a traditional media news media that, for the most part, that people could trust, and yes, they fell down and certain things. But there was a clearly defined sort of goal and standard, and people followed it. But honestly, now in the last few years, it's really completely deteriorated, and the lines are blurring between news and entertainment and news and opinion. And this year we've got Fox News transforming itself into a purely partisan and entirely political organization. So I've got young kids as well, and I don't envy trying to explain that, okay, if you want the real news, here, go to these four or five sites, and those are always dependable, and then the other stuff you have to sort of sift through. Because I can't really think of those four or five sites.
Oh my gosh, really?
That are now, you can always depend on what's in there. So, but then again, I mean, younger kids growing up, they're much more adept to dealing with, I think, a much more robust media landscape online and things like that. I mean, they're born online at this point. So honestly, that's the downside. The good side is, a lot of the fact checking, a lot of the alternative stuff, you can find on the internet, and it has been a godsend, and it has allowed a whole new generation of voices to hold people accountable and things like that. The hard part is you got to wade through it all, and it takes a long time. So it is sort of the good news, bad news situation.
Well, you just need to ask your children to find sites for you, right? that maybe they can do it better than we can.
That's right.
Yeah. We go next to Pat from Oconomowoc. Hi, Pat.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
I think I just have to respectfully just disagree a bit with your guest there. And I guess I would point out I hear a lot of bashing of Fox News consistently. But if I take a look at the MSNBC lineup from Keith Olbermann, Rachel Maddow, and Ed Schultz, I think those three in a row are far more left than, say, a Bill O'Reilly. I'll give you that Sean Hannity is definitely on the right, and he's maybe as far on the right as Keith Olbermann's on the left. But just to give an example, the day after, forgetting the gentleman's name, the Fort Hood massacre, he does his worser and, you know, whatever persons in the world. He had, I think, Rush Limbaugh was number two, and then some other conservative. And for some reason, the terrorists did not even seem to make the top three. And I just kind of think that's a little bit what we're dealing with in the media these days, whether you're talking on the right and on the left. It's completely partisan. And to just single out Fox News, I think we have to understand that as conservatives, that's the only news outlet that we feel even gives the other side. You know, CNN's got no ratings right now. MSNBC is fairly in the tank. And the reason why is because conservatives don't watch those stations, because you have seven news stations that spout the liberal, you know, opinion.
Well, I hear a lot of this analogy between Fox News and MSNBC, but I think if you dig a little deeper, it just doesn't hold up. MSNBC's entire morning show is hosted by a former Republican conservative member of Congress, Joe Scarborough. You cannot find one show in the entire week-long Fox News lineup that's hosted by a Democrat or a liberal or even a centrist. MSNBC, they have the primetime opinion programming, but you cannot look at MSNBC's news programming during the day and find just sort of like the avalanche of falsehoods and misinformation that you can at Fox News. I mean, Media Matters has spent the whole year documenting about how there is no wall between the Fox News opinion and the Fox News news. It's all the same thing. And Jon Stewart had a great video that went viral a couple of weeks ago where he completely sort of obliterated this notion that, you know, boy, during the day, Fox News is right down the middle AP
style. Yeah, I saw that.
And at night, you know, they offer some opinion. It's just not true. I mean, Fox used to say, well, you know, we're news all day, but then after Bill O'Reilly, we do opinion. And then they put Fox and Friends in the morning, and they said, well, we're news from 10 a.m. until Bill O'Reilly at night. And then they put Glenn Beck on at 5, and they said, well, we're news from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and then sort of after 7. But again, I mean, if you go to Media Matters, I mean, at least half of the stuff we document is just false misinformation, lies, comes during their news block. I'll just give you one classic example. One of the most embarrassing incidents last year, Fox News put up as its own research, it was on the stimulus bill, these sort of talking points. It turns out that the talking points came straight from the Republican National Committee, complete with typo, the same typo the RNC made. Fox News broadcast, put it on its screen as its own research. And again, this is during the news. I have never seen any incident where MSNBC simply takes a Democratic National Committee press release and puts it on the screen as its own research.
Yeah.
So I think they're two very different animals.
And yet MSNBC spends a whole lot of wasted time, in my opinion, taking on people at Fox. Why do they do that? Who cares?
Well, I think for Olbermann, it made his career.
Really?
Went from 300,000 viewers to probably over a million with his attacks on Keith Olbermann, and I think he believes it. I think he thinks there's something wrong with just allowing Fox News to do this sort of rampant misinformation like that. One other quick point I would make about Fox and MSNBC, even with their opinion stuff at night, it's so much different than Beck and Hannity and O'Reilly. Olbermann and Maddow don't just make stuff up. They don't just simply concoct stuff. I'll give you a perfect example. Again, Jon Stewart caught Sean Hannity. You know, he aired a report about this Tea Party rally in Washington, very small, drew like 4,000 people. And Sean Hannity was showing stock footage from a much larger September rally.
Mm-hmm.
So he this was a clear, obvious attempt to mislead his viewers, show this a video of a huge rally, and pretend it was for a much smaller rally. I know no example of Keith Olbermann or Rachel Maddow where they intentionally inserted the wrong video to try to mislead their viewers. Maddow and Olbermann are partisan, but they have a high standard of factual accuracy. Fox News, their opinion people have no standard whatsoever.
Well, just give us something other than Sarah Palin. That's our prayer of the day, right? Give us something that's got some meat. Thank you very much, Eric, for being with us.
I'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks. Eric Bollert, he is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America. He's the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. He worked as a senior writer for Salon, and he was with us the first part of this program. Earlier this half hour, John Allen Paulos, professor of math at Temple University in Philadelphia, our attempt this hour to ask for more from the press, from cable particularly, and also to figure out how certain stories that are erroneous or headlines that are erroneous find their way into the headlines. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to John Treader for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks everybody for your calls and your interest. A reminder, we're on Facebook now, so we can talk after the show if you want. Just go to WPR.org and maneuver your way to Kathleen Dunn and sign up. Thanks.